to my New Mexico mask that was made for me by Patricia Wagner. And I want to thank you, Patricia, for basically demonstrating incredible work and compassion and artistic ability. And thank you very much for sending me this do-it-yourself mask. It's incredible. Like I do for every press conference, I'm going to take this mask off so that there's good audio, but I wore it coming to the Capitol today. I will wear it going home and utilize it all of the time. All right, let's go to the case update. Okay, so on the slide, you can see that as of today, we have 5,364 total cases. Unfortunately, we have 155 new today. I'd really like that number to be lower. We'll talk a little bit more about that. We've got 200 hospitalizations, 52 individuals on ventilators, and we also are sad to report that we have 12 new deaths today, and that's bringing our total to 231 lost souls. This is always the most difficult news I receive every day. I know that it is incredibly hard on the New Mexico families and communities that are losing their loved ones, and everything we do is measured against saving as many lives as we can and making a difference in keeping as many New Mexicans safe as we can. I want to just point this out, but I'm going to go to Secretary Kunkel as soon as I say it. We are now at 115,011 total tests. That is an ineffective number for what I want to accomplish in the state, which is much broader surveillance. Given what's available in the country, it is an effective effort by this state at making sure that we're doing as much widespread testing as we can. And with that, I'm going to go to Secretary Kunkel for an update.
Thank you, Governor, and good afternoon, everyone. As the governor said, we're over 115,000 tests. We continue to expand our testing criteria so that we can reach more and more New Mexicans. And on Monday of this week, the Department of Health announced that we would now be testing any worker that wanted to be tested. We are making that available largely through the Department of Health. Something like that requires significant resources, both in supplies and in personnel. So if you are interested, if you are an employee, you're interested in getting tested, call your local public health office. Or if you are a business seeking a more of a larger event, call your local office and we will schedule that for you. I did have a slide on, there we go. As we talked about last week, we are increasing our presence in border communities, primarily in the Southwest, which Secretary Scrace will surely be talking about, and in the Northwest, where we've always been, had a presence. But these are the open parks and the border cities where we are concerned about seeing traffic from our sister states. You will see an increased presence of the Department of Health and our partners providing testings in these communities. And so the message this week is, all workers, please get tested. If you can't come to us, we will come to you. Thank you.
And as we're getting ready to go to Dr. Scrace, have you focused? Thank you. I just want to point out that we're still hearing from some individuals that they can't get tested, that their employers are saying they can't. You can get tested. We're really working hard. We're going to have local elected officials also work on getting the message out. We are present in many communities, and it's basically open testing. We want to know as much about where our risks are, and if somebody's COVID-19, we want them isolated, right, for 14 days, that quarantine period, so that we don't infect anybody else. We need to know, and so we're coming into these communities, and I just really want to hit that point really hard. We want you to get tested. Information, that knowledge, is not only going to protect you and your family and your neighbors and your friends and your community, it's going to keep more New Mexicans safe, and it's going to save lives. So think about testing in that context. You can help us save a life by finding out whether or not you have the virus. So that's very helpful to us, and I just really wanted to hit that hard. Dr. Scrace, you want to go over the modeling with us?
Yes, I'm happy to, okay. Governor. Thank you. We are going to present a little bit different data today, but I wanted to start with the very first slide, which compares all of New Mexico, which is the blue dotted line, to just the Northwest, which is the red solid line, and to the rest of New Mexico that's not the Northwest, which is the Green Line. And we talked about this last time, and I said there was some early evidence that we might be seeing a downward trend in cases, and sure enough, we are. We've got 6 or 7 days. You can see the red line is now clearly coming down. The blue line is also coming down in relationship to that. I'm still a little nervous about the green line. I've shown you multiple slides of double peak epidemics, and we're actually seeing sort of an uptick in cases in the rest of the state, and we'll talk about that a little bit more specifically. But the ending of all three of those lines is favorable, so we're starting to see the downward trend, and that's great. On the next slide, we've got the gating criteria, and just as a reminder, these are the things that we have to do and accomplish as a state to be ready for further reopening. And I'm going to go through each one of them briefly, although I'll spend a little bit more time on spread because we got a lot of questions about that last week. The spread rate, I'll talk about in a minute. Testing, we're really dramatically increasing. I say this every week. We had 4,542 tests yesterday. We're actually in the top 10 states in the country in terms of the proportion of our population that we've tested, but we're continuing to push that upward for the reasons the governor mentioned, because we can identify people, we can quarantine them so they don't spread the disease to others. Contact tracing and isolation capacity. I told you we would have metrics this week, but we're in the process of automating the contact tracing process, computerizing the tracking of that, and it turns out the existing system only keeps one timestamp, so it's very hard to measure two different times. And so as that gets automated, we'll have more for you on that, but we are ramping up contact tracing, and I don't think that's something that would hold us back from moving forward. And then lastly, the statewide healthcare system capacity. We're focusing on our 7 hub hospitals. I said 8 last week, and there are really 9 of them, but just go with me on this. Presbyterian has multiple hospitals, so does some other systems. So we're focused on those hub hospitals. We did actually go above regular capacity early mid last week. We were at 120% of ICU capacity, but I've also let you know that of the 260 baseline beds, the brilliant people who are leading the delivery system effort on the medical advisory team have found ways to actually double that number, and so we still have capacity. So we're good with the statewide healthcare system. Let's talk about rate of spread, and if you're new to this, the rate of spread sort of answers the question, how many people on average does one person with COVID infect in New Mexico right now? We know that there's another rate of spread for COVID that is where the answer is that left without any social distancing and without any strategies, one person with COVID will infect somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 other people. So our result here in New Mexico is excellent. We're down to 1.16. Our goal is 1.15. It's been coming down by about 1/100 of a point every day. So good progress. But like I said last week, there's good news and there's areas of concern, and it seems like every week the area of concern changes, but we can break down that spread rate. And on the next slide up, I'll show you that, if I could have that please, by the 5 public health regions in the state. And so you can see we had an error in the slide last week. Last week, Metro was 1.16. They're 1.09, so below the target. Northeast, still below the target. Southeast, now below the target. And the Southwest, this is really good news, and it goes along with the graph I showed at the beginning, is coming down as well. From 1.33 to 1.23. The Southwest, I said that wrong. The Northwest, the bottom line, is coming down. It was 1.31 last week. It's 1.2 this week. And of concern, and let me say this correctly, the Southwest is actually going up. The spread rate is going up there, 1.23 last week, above target, up to 1.33, well above target. And so you can see Southwest, spread rate is higher than the Northwest was last week. We're watching that area very, very closely. Secretary Kunkel is doing extra, her team is doing extra testing along the border. We're working with mayors and legislators in that area to heighten awareness and work out a plan. So this is something we'll be watching very, very closely in the coming week. We don't have enough data yet to say something for sure, but it's clearly at the very center of our radar screen. And then I got a couple questions this week from folks like, won't the spread rate go up if we do more testing? And the answer to that question is no. And just briefly for the science audience out there, the rate of spread is only calculated from positive cases, number one. And number two, it's calculated based on the ratio of, for example, positive cases we had today versus positive cases yesterday or earlier in the week. So as we do more testing, we'll get more tests altogether, we'll get more positive tests, but that ratio stays constant. And so that's not something you need to work with. I have a paper that I'm sending to people. If you have a math professor in your family, I can send it to you. But it's a method for calculating rate of spread that's really ingenious, that was developed during the SARS epidemic in 2002 and 3, and it was tested and validated then, retested and validated during H1N1, and it seems to be tracking very well with what our modeling is showing here in our state. So if you noticed, New Mexico is the first one to actually use the spread rate as a gating criteria, and now it's become extremely popular, and other states and other countries are now reporting that. We've seen Germany's go way down to 0.65, now back up as they've reopened, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So just, if I could have the next slide, please, just quickly, spread is improving. I think we'll be on target for May 15th. Testing is rapidly improving, but because we're doing a 7-day rolling average, we might not be quite there on May 15th. Contact tracing being automated and the delivery system capacity is good. But in the end of the day, all four of these things are driven by what we do as New Mexicans, the extent to which we stay at home, wash our hands, clean things off, cough into tissues, all the other things and actually face coverings in public and maintaining that 6-foot distancing you'll be hearing about as well. Last week, I also mentioned that we do a science update every day, bringing evidence from the medical literature, thanks to the folks on the mat who deliver that to us. And so I'm going to give you a couple examples of the sort of things we talk about. One thing we haven't talked about very much is children, and this is becoming a big issue here in New Mexico right now. We can probably turn the slide off. This is just a couple examples. But just so you know, in the last 2 weeks, we've gone from having 7% of our cases occur in children between the ages of 0 and 19 to 13%. So it's almost doubled in 2 weeks, the percentage. That puts us as the second highest state in the country for the percent of kids who have infections, just in Wyoming being number one. And to give you even more perspective, we're at 13%. The U.S. average is 3.2%. So the infection rate in children in New Mexico is 4 times higher than it is than the national average. And I wanted to, thanks to the folks at the Department of Health and Janice Gonzalez, just highlight a couple things for parents who are watching and for kids who might be watching. In children, pay particular attention to abdominal symptoms or nausea or vomiting, diarrhea. Those kinds of symptoms are more prominent in kids. If your child has one of those symptoms and a fever, or they've been in contact with someone who's COVID positive, you should assume that your child has a COVID infection and get them tested right away. So that's really important in kids. It's different than in adults, and it's important to get on that early and get the kids tested. Another thing that's going on internationally is there's this new unusual autoimmune disorder that's very, very serious, has infected more than 200 kids. It may be related to something called Kawasaki syndrome, and I won't go into that into detail today. I'll spare you that. But so we may have found the cause of Kawasaki syndrome that was postulated to be related to other kinds of coronavirus, but this can be very serious. And so we're starting to see kids in the United States, over 60 kids, seriously affected with this disorder as well. And then my last point on children, and this is to parents and practitioners and the general public, we've seen about a 20% drop in immunizations during the pandemic. That's to be expected. We're keeping people, particularly with respiratory symptoms, away from offices, and people are volunteering to stay away as well. But now that we've reopened and expanded medical practices a couple weeks ago, it is okay, and we really encourage you to get your kids caught up on their immunizations. We don't want to have other sort of outbreaks of other infectious diseases because we've neglected that. So please, please reach out to your pediatrician or your family practitioner or whoever your provider, and make an appointment to get those immunizations done. Next thing I want to talk about briefly, and there's a lot of articles coming out about face masks, but if I could have the next slide. I made a little bit of reference to this last week, and I put the link in, so if you get the presentation, you can just click on it and read the article yourself. It was based on the outbreak in New York, and so they had a lot of cases and a lot of data, but they really found that if 80% of us were to adopt a simple homemade face mask, we could reduce deaths by 17 to 45% over a two-month period of time, and also the daily peak rate of deaths. And in New Mexico, looking out over the long run, over the next 12 months, all of us wearing masks could save thousands of lives. And so just a little bit of evidence. You're going to hear more about that in a couple of minutes. There's about five or six articles, and all of them are tending in the same direction, that face masks, they're not as effective as what we need healthcare professionals to be doing, but they are effective to some degree in protecting other people from you and keeping you from spreading the disease. And since we know 44% of people get COVID from someone who doesn't have symptoms yet, it's a really, really important innovation. And so let's go to the next slide. And this is kind of scary. If you're scared by this, you're in good company with myself, all the epidemiology doctors. There was a choir practice, you probably saw, some of you may have seen this on the news, 2.5-hour choir practice in Washington State, attended by 61 people, and 52 of them, the CDC believes, got COVID. 87% of people in that room for 2.5 hours. They sang in a big group, they sang in small groups, some of them had refreshments, but not everybody. And actually, and really sadly, three patients were hospitalized and two died. And it turns out that singing is a super spreader event if you're COVID positive. The force of singing sends the virus out further. Loud speaking in public does the same thing. And so we really want to make sure people are aware that how dangerous large groups can be, and that physical distancing, face coverings and the like can be helpful. And the last point on this that I think is really important is we all need to be really aware of what is going on in our communities related to COVID. I went on the map today and looked at my zip code and found out that we had a new case that I didn't know about. And you can do that too. It's on the DOH website. You can see the number of cases in your zip code. But this doesn't, not just for your own county or zip code, but neighboring counties, zip codes, and even neighboring states. For example, if you live in Las Cruces, let's go back one slide, let's go back, yeah. If you live in Las Cruces, you should know that there are now more cases in El Paso than there are in Albuquerque. You should know that going across the state line for dinner or bowling or whatever it is that's now available there not only puts you at risk, but it puts your family at risk as well. And I really want to reach out today and have people think about the people that are high risk, and I'll mention them in a minute, because it isn't just you and whether you're at high risk, but other people you interact with in your family or that you see on a regular basis that get placed at risk as well. 1,348 cases as of yesterday in El Paso, 1,111 in Albuquerque as of yesterday. And then my last slide, and this is just a pitch about opening, because we've been saying for a couple weeks, we need to learn how to live in a COVID world, because this is going to go on for 15 to 18 more months until we have an effective, proven vaccine. But what we're starting to see in other countries like China, Germany, Italy, and France, and other states, Florida, Georgia, Minnesota, is number one, and this is interesting, that even talking about reopening, people start going out more and the case count goes up. But actual reopening we will see more cases, we'll see more hospitalizations, we'll see more deaths. And so it's actually harder work as we start reopening to keep the social distancing up. It's riskier, and particularly vulnerable people and those at risk, you all need to stay at home for a much longer period of time. In the phase one world, people with, who are over 70, who have diabetes, asthma, immune disorders, or getting treated for cancer, pregnant women, or you live in a congregate living facility, like a nursing facility, assisted living facility, shelter, much higher risk. And so as you hear more about reopening today, remember that some of these things will only apply to you later on. I think we can do this, but it is a tightrope walk. We're gonna have to go slow. We're gonna have to maintain our balance. We're gonna closely watch every piece of data that we have all across the state to inform our decision-making. But we need you all, people in New Mexico, to be the ones that bend that curve and keep it flat as we make these changes. So thank you, Governor.
All right, so where are we and what's happening? Let's do the first slide. I know that folks are really interested since we're at the end of our public health order. So we believe, based on meeting, by and large, the gating criteria. Remember those four areas that are about testing, that are about rate of transmission, that are about contact tracing, that make sure that we've got hospital and health service capacity. So most of those are met, but they're different in some regions of the state. And contact tracing, which is the only way we really get at stopping spread, and you're gonna have more spread when you open up, that has to be done, and we aren't quite there. But we think we are getting close enough that we can talk right now about moving into the next phases. All right, so we're gonna continue to talk about gating, I just did. We're gonna continue to let public health, in fact, it's not just letting Dr. Scrace, we're gonna demand in New Mexico that the science guide every single decision we make through having access to treatment and vaccines. And the spread of the virus, people ask me all the time, give me a date certain. When is this gonna happen? When can I participate in X? When can we have large gatherings? When will there be a concert? The virus decides that, and our behavior as the virus lives among us. Those are the deciding factors, and so every decision will be made based on that. Next slide, just wanna remind folks, that's how we do this. So. On May 16th, Friday, this is what's gonna remain the same, and I just wanna make sure we go over this, and it should, I hope, be pretty obvious. It is imperative that you continue to stay home. So the stay-at-home instructions, these are effective instructions that people should expect that we will continue to renew until there's a vaccine. So a lot of people have said, the state's not gonna move here, we're not gonna think about opening any business until there's a vaccine. No, we have a gating criteria so that we can move safely, prudently, smartly, and effectively. We don't wanna go backwards and have to shut everything down, but staying at home, only leaving when necessary, limiting that effort, limiting who you come into contact with, well, that needs to stay. All right, particularly if you're sick or you're one of the vulnerable high-risk populations. So we're gonna keep pressing that message and we're gonna keep it in the public health orders. All right, slight reopenings, and I promise I will get to that. It is not an invitation. We are gonna not do that today, but we could spend 2 hours with photos of folks out and about, not adhering to any of our public health order requirements. No social distancing, no limits in terms of gatherings, and of course we're talking to folks about that. Where appropriate, there's an enforcement activity to a business or a group, but this virus moves with you, and there are plenty, including in golf courses, where folks demonstrated to the medical advisory team and others that this was gonna be a really easy, safe invitation to open up outdoor activities by looking at a couple of the golf courses that have 20 golfers all standing around, no social distancing. I would suggest it didn't quite get there. So we're gonna really work hard on our social contract with each other, and these are not invitations to unnecessarily leave your home, remaining home, except for emergencies and for the things that you need to get done and for exercise and getting outdoors with your family. That's the safest course. We're going to stay that course. So we're going to continue to prohibit congregating in large groups and numbers of people. So we're going to keep that tight and small. We're going to be in our bubbles of four in yourself, so five. We're going to stay the course there because that means that we can safely reopen in areas that we need to start doing. All right, and if you must go out 6 feet, notice, I'm going to say that we're 12 to 18 feet apart. 6 feet is the minimum, not the maximum. So really keep that in mind. Next slide. All right. So if that's all staying the same, what changes? All right. We're going to open up all retailers. Anybody who sells goods or services can now open as of this weekend at 25% of their fire code capacity. So what does that mean? All right, it means that we expect you, right, to have COVID safe practices, that your employees and staff are wearing masks and anything else that really works at stopping the spread of the virus. That depends on the kind of retailer you are. And those practices have to be in place before you operate. Most of these businesses have been participating with us, so they have advance notice, know what to do, know where to access some of the face masks and other protective gear or clothing that people ought to be using. I did get a comment today that the fire code capacity for older historic buildings could be tough, and we have a vehicle to help work with businesses to make sure that they're doing that right. Let's do the definition, right? Any businesses, and I did it once already, that sells goods or services directly to the ultimate consumer end user. All right, retail spaces do not include wholesalers or suppliers, and they do not today include, so here's the exclusion, entertainment venues such as movie theaters, concert halls, or amusement parks. So those are still excluded from being able to open even at 25%. Larger retailers, particularly those essential businesses like grocery stores and some of our big box hardware stores, they are remaining at 20%. Smaller, 25, larger, and it'll be defined, and it has been, 20% maximum occupancy. All right, now, I want to also just highlight, this does not yet apply, this new opening, to the Northwestern Public Health Region. All right, that's Cibola, McKinley, and San Juan counties, where we're seeing improvements, but the risk of spread still remains too high. Next slide. All right, we're also going to open up some other non-essential businesses like office spaces, call centers. They can also operate with up to 25% of the pre-crisis staffing levels. All right, employees, if you can, you should continue to work from home, and telework policies should remain in effect for as many of our offices and workspace environments as humanly possible. Why? Because again, the fewer people, the more control we have over the virus. Houses of worship may operate at 10% occupancy. I want to talk about this a little bit, a couple of things. We are working with the faith-based community on COVID-safe practices and figuring out our strategies to safely reopen so that their members and parishioners can participate in very meaningful, right, important services in their communities. The 10% immediately gets us to baptisms, daily masses, and counseling, which has really been tough to do in that sort of tele or drive-up environment that many houses of worship were able to accomplish in a COVID-safe vehicle to support their church members. I just want to highlight the incredible work and leadership that was demonstrated by the faith-based community. I also want to point out that many congregations are going to choose to stay closed and to offer services, faith-based services, in different vehicles for longer periods of time. And we applaud that decision, not because we don't think that practicing your faith isn't important and meaningful and also legally protected in many circumstances and should be. We understand that and we want that. But it's also high risk. Why is it high risk? Number of people, length of duration of that activity, they're not in and then out. And it's difficult to change those durations because these are the faith-based practices are thousands of years old, and we are clear about that time frame. I understand that. We are working with them to work on other strategies to keep their members safe, but to make sure that they can, as safely and quickly as possible, continue to retain as many of their services as possible. So I just wanted to give them a shout out and thank them for that and to show that we're working on providing relief to their members who miss their pastors and their church leaders. And we're clear about that. And we think that this is the first step towards effective public health and safe returns. Now, notice that I gave that long speech and description about houses of worship. Because what we're adding, non-essential workplaces, retailers, means that we use that John Hopkins model, right? Number of people, the duration of that contact, and the intensity of that contact. That's part of our guide. We have to meet the gating criteria, then we test the businesses and efforts against that John Hopkins model. And that's why not everything is in, because we're excluding, for the time being, high-intensity contact services. So dine-in restaurants, indoor malls, salons, and gyms need to be in the next phase. And again, none of this applies to the Northwestern area because, again, they have their risks are still too high. Next slide. But what could apply to McKinley and San Juan and Cibola counties, given that we're seeing a flattening and a shift in the right direction? We're going to move that region of the state into the preparation phase. That's where everybody else was just about 2 weeks ago, May 1st, all right? So I'm going to go over that quickly. Non-essential retailers may open and provide curbside pickup or delivery. So if you're a retailer, furniture store as an example, then you can create an operation that allows folks to do curbside and delivery for your services. Golf courses, pet and veterinary services may open. Firearm shops can operate by appointment only. And the stay-at-home order, of course, remains in place for everyone, for everything that we're doing that's shifting. Next slide. Okay. Now, we are also, this has got a ton of stuff on it. I'm going to go quickly, but given what you just heard and what I've been briefed on daily about the risks both to young people and that they are super spreaders, we are going to do a very modified, very limited summer youth programs will be permissible with significant restrictions. All right, so these are going to be in-person summer programs and some sports camps are going to be available but restricted. A 5-to-1 child to adult ratio for children who live in the local geographic area. So we are already working with communities to figure out what that looks like and how folks would register in that way. Student and staff groupings have to be self-contained, and the same children have to stay with the same staff. So you can't mix between groups. So if you think about two small sports groups in a large park, they can't come together at any point and they can't trade staff. You gotta stay in your groups because that mitigates risk. High-risk staff and children must be informed on the need for additional actions, such as, frankly, not attending. And they need to be really clear about reducing contact with high-risk family members. So what does that mean? If you have a child that has a pre-existing condition, or you are living and caretaking for someone that's older or with pre-existing conditions, we recommend that you do not participate in any of these programs. The risks, quite frankly, are too great for you. And these questions will be asked and you'll be reminded that this is not the right effort at this time for individuals and those families. Sports programs have to be restricted to contactless sports only and non-competitive play. We know families are really ready to give their kids access to our parks and our programs, but we want to go very slow. And I just want to point out 640 young people in New Mexico have contracted this virus. And with what we now know, I'm concerned enough that in our contact tracing, we're going to reach out to the families of all 640 and make sure that they know what to look for even after the virus or what to look for with other of their children. We're concerned about some of the latent inflammatory diseases and issues that are occurring in children who contract COVID-19 or children who have had COVID-19. So we're going to be incredibly careful here, and I know we'll have your support to make sure we keep our children safe. Next slide. Okay, everyone that gets to open, everyone that's been open, has to make sure that they have what we're going to call CSFs. COVID safe practices for all retailers. They have to adhere to the occupancy limits by the public health order. You have to have face coverings for all of your employees. You have to maintain a very stringent sanitizing schedule for all of your businesses, with particular attention to high touch areas, doors and credit card terminals, as an example. You have to establish where you can protocols for contactless pickup and delivery. Everywhere you can, you got to keep that. And then more specific COVID safe practices for individual industries are being finalized as we speak. And I want to thank again the groups working with the cabinets and the Recovery Council in particular for making sure that we get these done. Next slide. All right. So where are we going after that? Well, part two of phase one, we broke it in two. We believe if we stay the course, and we're seeing mitigation for the whole state, even though we've got some hot spots that we're identifying. And what we mean by hot spots, we don't like that rate of transmission. We don't like the number of cases. Even with today's cases, when I see an increase of cases, right, these are data points that are problematic. So we're really going to be paying attention in the next 2 weeks to see if we can, in early June, go to this. So the more high intensity contacts could be phased in the first part of June, and that would include salons, barbers, gyms, indoor malls, dine-in restaurants with limited occupancy, and all COVID safe practices in place. We expect that there would be potential expansion of occupancy for houses of worship and expansion for occupancy in hotels and motels. Again, we're going to go to the gating criteria. We're really going to look at that rate of transmission and testing, contact tracing, and hospital capacity. Your personal decisions will determine whether or not we move into these next phases. So next slide. All right, this is very different than what I said last week. I was really concerned about enforcement. I still am. Citing individuals for not wearing masks and being in a family gathering that's 8 instead of 5 is a really complicated, really punitive effort. It also taxes all of our first responders in ways that I don't think is fair to any of our communities. This really depends on you. However, because I said I would follow the public health guidance, then in fact, we are mandating as of the 16th, in our public health orders, everyone in New Mexico will wear masks in public spaces. All right, and so I want to go through that. Saturday, everyone in New Mexico must wear a face covering. So when do you have to wear one? In any public setting. If you're not in your house, you're not doing what I'm doing right now and talking to a camera briefly with huge social distancing, and you didn't come down in a mask, all right, you have to wear it. Here are the exceptions. Eating, so when we get to dine-in restaurants, You can't eat or drink with a mask on. We're clear. And if you can exercise, I recommend it with a face mask. But for a lot of outdoor exercising activities, really too hard, and certainly something that most folks are telling us, it makes it impossible for them to exercise. And we're promoting good health in every context that we can. And now, as the state opens up more and more and our risk increases, the only way we save lives and keep the gating criteria where it is if we're all wearing face coverings. And this is not something that we're used to or accustomed to. And I just really want us to do the right thing here. Now, it's not a guarantee against the virus, and we've talked about that, that while these mitigate, right, they slow and stop the spread in many ways, it is not a guarantee that you can't give the virus and that you can't get the virus, because it's not a respirator-type mask, but it really helps slow the spread, and that's why we're going to mandate it. And I want to show you right now that folks are, I think, nervous around the country and gonna be nervous here that masks are hard to make. Now, I wanna show you, I'm gonna move all this, that we're not requiring that it's a sewn mask, and we're not requiring that you purchase a mask. We're not gonna require that you try to get, please don't, try to get masks that we reserve for first responders and healthcare workers. We're not suggesting that, we don't want that, but I wanna show you how easy it is to make a face covering. All right, so any fabric, including a bandana, and quite frankly, if it's a big enough bandana, you can just tie it and cover your nose and mouth. I'm going to show you how to make one that's a little more fitted. All right, open it up. There you go. All right, you want to take each side, fold it to the middle, like so. All right. I make sure that you do that so that it's going to fit nicely and not cover your eyes. Do another fold to the middle, both sides, two folds to the middle, okay? Next, you fold the ends in, right? Make that little triangle, fold the ends in. Do this side, fold the ends in. Try to hold them. I'm not going to iron this for you today, but that does help. These are hair ties. Right, you could use a rubber band, not as comfortable. I've done that. Done that actually at a press conference. So hair ties work, I think, much better. Slide them just as you get for me, and it's really dependent on the size of your face area you're trying to cover. I get it to where it just starts to be wide in the front for me. That's what I need. All right, now you're gonna roll these that fold its ends to the middle, and this helps, I think, keep it on and snug. I tuck, not necessary, but you'll see that I tucked one end into the other, right? I made kind of a knot just by tucking it in. All right, I'm gonna press down, and you have a face covering. That's it. See, I could do a little more tucking. You're looking to cover your nose and your mouth. Anything will do. Any kind of fabric will do. I want to say one more thing about this.
Good job.
Huh?
Good job.
Good job. I don't know that it's enough to get me on a do-it-yourself or cooking show, but it's a good first step. We get a lot of questions about gloves, and all of these things can be an added protective effort. And I want to point out a couple of things. One, if you don't know how to use gloves, and I don't mean that to sound trite or unfair at all, but it's very easy to think that your hands are safe, you've touched many surfaces, like in a grocery store, and then you touch your face. That's a problem. You've touched many surfaces, and you should touch only the item that you're getting, put it into your basket, right? And then you go to the checkout and you're spreading potentially the virus. I think gloves can be useful. I require my family, because I think it's good practice where they have access to disposable gloves, to wear them when they get out of the car, to pump fuel, and then to immediately discard safely those gloves. And again, don't touch your face at all if you can help it. For me, it's incredibly hard. So what do? Hand sanitizer, hand washing, soap and water immediately. Those are better tools than trying to figure out gloves and not doing cross-contamination. If you have access to disposable gloves, one use only, I think that that's helpful. Certainly not something that we think is prudent to require. This really makes an impact. What about kids? Kids have to wear them too. What do you think about toddlers, four-year-olds? Really hard. I think it's important to get them used to it, but what does it also do? It encourages a toddler to touch their face. So you'll, in these youth programs and in childcare, there's been specific attention to training and support so that those experts know how to navigate with families. And I'm gonna ask my experts to get some of that information right on our website, nmcovid19sothat.org, so you can see it. But we get asked those questions a lot. And lastly, if you don't wanna make a mask, or you can't make a mask, if you're a high-risk population, we have individuals who are homeless, and they don't have access to any of the things that so many of us can take for granted. The state will get a do-it-yourself mask to you, and we're going to make that as easy as we can. We're going to get it on our website. We'll mail them to you. We've got more than 400 sewers. Thank you, every one of you who are making these. We've distributed thousands already, and we'll help get them to places and to businesses that are struggling to role model this effort. Last thing about this. I'm hoping that our elected leaders, and I've gotten real commitments, bipartisan, from mayors and county commissioners and city councilors, they're going to wear masks, it's required. They are going to constantly remind their communities that it's required. Gentle reminding, peer pressure that's positive, not negative. This is how we do productive enforcement. And is it possible that a first responder or police officer might bark at you from their window? It is, because it saves lives. Are we going to be a state that tries to enforce in ways that are punitive? We are not. Please, it's not an invitation to not wear a mask. And we are expecting the right kind of role modeling, because the only way we live in a COVID-19 world and we open up businesses and we start to change to a new normal, if we don't do this, you end up right back where you were, and that's happened to states. And you can see that on any number of COVID-19 national and international websites and states. My good friend, my governor in Minnesota, is seeing that they're having an increase. And so opening up businesses is a risk. This mitigates risks, save lives. We're gonna do it in New Mexico. All right, do I have any more slides? I don't even remember. All right, I know it was a long presentation. We're moving in, right, to retailers and offices being open. We're gonna open up more parks. We're gonna open up more opportunities for New Mexicans. We're gonna require everyone to wear a mask, and we're gonna have COVID-safe operating practices in all of our businesses. We're gonna use that 14-day criteria. We do 7-day rolling averages and gating so we can see it in as real time as possible. We're gonna be guided by public health data and science. And I believe in New Mexico. I believe that we can do this effectively together. The basic stay-at-home instructions remain. But I know people are anxious to finish their projects, to visit their retailers. I need you to do that responsibly and safely. So please wear a mask and stay in these small groups. All right, thank you for tuning in today. Thank you for every community working to make a difference. We are, in fact, all in this together, New Mexico, and it's working. Not everything's where I want it to be, where it should be, but it's working, and that's because of you. All right, let's go to questions.
Thank you, Governor. First, we're gonna go to Julia Goldberg with the Santa Fe Reporter. Julia, you're unmuted. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hey, let me just unmute the Governor.
In New Mexico.
I had a question about the modeling update from yesterday. I just wanted to make sure that I understood. It had said that prevalence rates have increased across all regions since last week. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about how to interpret that data and what context to put it in. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. I'm going to go back to Dr. Scrace, but it's looking at those 7-day averages so that we're getting more than one data point. We do, in fact, use, and Dr. Scrace will correct me if I get this wrong, we do, in fact, I look at, right, the increased cases, if you get those per day, and we also look at the percentage positives out of the number tested. That's another data point. It's not a gating criteria, but it is data points that we compare to that rate of transmission. And again, we do it over a several day average. So I'm gonna go to Dr. Scrace, and that's why one day's data is insufficient for us to make modeling decisions.
Right, and thank you, Governor. The formula for prevalence is complicated, and I've tried this before and created confusion, but basically it's an expression of the percent of people in a given county who have a positive test for COVID, the easiest way to say it. And when you have 1,500 or 2,000 new cases in a week's period of time, or 1,000 to 1,500, sorry, you're gonna see the number of people who have it go up and the population of that county doesn't go up. So it's normal to see prevalence rates rise. And even when we're over the peak and coming back down, the prevalence itself never goes down because it's you're adding cases. And so that's, we did see new cases in all four regions of the state. It's nothing particularly alarming. It's what we expect. And but thanks for that question. I won't go into the per 100,000 because that's where people get lost. But just think of it as the percent of people who have the disease. And each time we add someone, that percent goes up a little.
It is, and I'm going to actually, just as a policymaker, I am always disturbed every time there's an additional case, right? As a policymaker, I want to kick the virus out of New Mexico, and I want to kick it out of the country, and I don't want us to be in a pandemic. There's not a policymaker that doesn't want that, so I have a early negative reaction for and should. For every hospitalization, every ICU, every ventilator, every horrific death, and every additional case. But that's why I follow unequivocally the modeling science. And you know, I want to just remind New Mexicans about this. We get challenged, the whole country's being challenged about how you do modeling. Fair, we want folks to do the math themselves and ask us questions. And we want to be as educated as possible. I think that's really healthy and productive. But we use private laboratories who assist us and reevaluate and review our modeling. We also use the national laboratories and even that rate of transmission, which is complicated, can be math. Those are sound epidemiological efforts. And I am really clear and very serious, and I believe have created a very effective, and it's being copied, very effective science-based modeling system that is reviewed, frankly, in the way which we do it, it's peer-reviewed. So thank you for that question. I just wanted to give you a shout out for asking it.
Thank you, Governor. Next, I'm gonna go to Matt Grubbs with New Mexico PBS. Matt, you are unmuted. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, thanks. Governor, I wanted to talk a little bit about contact tracing. As best I can figure, you're much more reliant on cell phone monitoring. To the extent that that is the case, who is going to have oversight to make sure that data isn't being stored or misused? And to the extent that you're using human contact tracers, how many will you use? How many do you have? And how long does it take to train someone?
All right, so the first part, we don't use cell phone data to do contact tracing at all. We do that for aggregate movement data, and it's not a gating criteria, but it can show us, right? So if we have rate of transmission issues that increase, if we have cases that, and we do, cases that increase, you know, you can look at mobility data and get a sense about what's going on in a community. I also look at what I call, right, the sight, taste, and smell data. If I get in the car, and I have, and I travel to Albuquerque, and I have, and I visit my family car to car or front yard to window, and I have, I see things that I think absolutely are in violation of the public health order, and I'm really distressed by it. And so I can tell without the cell phone mobility data that the traffic is too high, that the lines are too long, and that people are not socially distancing. And I take notes, and we do friendly reminders, and for businesses that are absolutely violating purposely the public health orders, in fact, they're cited, and we do the enforcement work we should do. So